Okay, I think we're on. Welcome everyone to another En Conjunto table talk. My name is Leopoldo Sanchez. I also go by Leo Sanchez, but Leo sounds like the word in Spanish for trouble.
What's your point?
Well, you know me too well. But it's nice to have you here today, and the topic for discussion is the Virgin of Guadalupe, La Virgen de Guadalupe, La Morenita, the little brown virgin. A powerful, not only cultural, but also religious and even political symbol, image in Mexican culture. About 65% of all Latinos in the United States are of Mexican origin. So that is the largest Hispanic group in the nation. And an image of such significance, historically, religiously, and so on, in Mexican culture has to be dealt with at some point. We see the image of the Virgin of Guadalupe many places. We see people with tattoos of the Virgin of Guadalupe. We see it, you know, in the taxi. You know, maybe the taxi driver has an image of the Virgin hanging from somewhere in the car, and we have it in the. You go to Mexican towns and you see it in the businesses and so on. So it's a dominant image. So we like to reflect a little bit on this, and I will be. Drawing on some literature from, on the one hand, kind of the Roman Catholic reading of the Virgin of Guadalupe, and then I'll have some things to say sort of from a Lutheran standpoint. So I will be engaging primarily in reading from Virgilio Elizondo, who is considered sort of the father of Roman Catholic U.S. Latino theology. He's a theologian, a priest in San Antonio, Texas, who also teaches at Notre Dame University. And then someone else that I'll be engaging would be Maxwell Johnson, who is a Lutheran liturgiologist who also teaches at Notre Dame University. I believe he was probably an advisor or a professor at some point for Drs. Burson and Maxwell. So they know Maxwell Johnson from their own experience at Notre Dame. So let's do a little bit of that. But first, let me just read to you from Luke 1, the Magnificat. And Mary said, "My soul magnifies the Lord, and my spirit rejoices in God my Savior. For he has looked with favor on the lowliness of his servant. Surely from now on all generations will call me blessed. For the Mighty One has done great things for me, and holy is his name. His mercy is for those who fear him from generation to generation. He has shown strength with his arm. He has scattered the proud in the thoughts of their hearts. He has brought down the powerful from their thrones and lifted up the lowly. He has filled the hungry with good things and sent the rich away empty. He has helped his servant Israel in remembrance of his mercy, according to the promise he made to our ancestors, to Abraham and to his descendants forever." The Magnificat. Now, let me give you a little bit of background by just rehearsing the story of Guadalupe again, and then we're going to go into maybe some initial reactions to Guadalupe or the Guadalupan symbol, especially from the Protestant side of things. Okay. But first, the story of Guadalupe. According to a legend first published in 1648, in the year 1531, La Virgen de Guadalupe appeared in the form of a young mestizo woman to a Christianized Indian named Juan Diego. Now, a mestizo, as you know, is a person of mixed blood, generally speaking. Typically, we think Spaniard-Indian, but sometimes it's used more broadly to mean people of mixed blood. The fruit, in a sense, of the violent encounter between the Spaniard and the native Amerindian in the conquest of the Americas. That will be significant, as we shall see in a little bit. In any case, the sound of music led San Diego, or led, well, Juan Diego, now San Diego, because he was at some point, was it by John Paul II?
Yeah, canonized.
He was canonized by John Paul II, that's right, not too long ago. So the sound of music led Juan Diego to Tepeyac Hill, which is near Mexico City. And it's the location, or used to be the location, of a shrine to the Aztec deity Tonantzin, where the apparition of the Virgin reportedly took place. Between December 9th and the 12th of 1531, the Virgin of Guadalupe continued to appear to Juan Diego. She repeatedly sent Juan Diego to the bishop-elect of Mexico, Fray Juan de Zumárraga. She requested through Juan Diego that a church dedicated to her be built on the site so that she can show and give forth all her love, compassion, help, and defense to all the inhabitants of this land, to hear their lamentations and remedy their miseries, pain, and sufferings. Now, when Zumárraga, the bishop, demanded proof that this was taking place, the Virgin told Juan Diego to gather roses from a nearby hillside, put them into his cloak, his tilma, and bring them to the bishop. When the roses were released, the Virgin's image was imprinted on the tilma, which now hangs in the Basilica in Mexico City, and is an object of veneration, daily devotion, and has made that temple a major pilgrimage site. So that's sort of the brief version of the story, the encounter between this Indio, Juan Diego, and this young mestizo Virgin. I should probably mention that in 1754, Pope Benedict XIV officially recognized the Guadalupe tradition by bringing it into the official liturgy of the Roman Catholic Church. So that's the background to the story of Guadalupe. And maybe a place to start here is sort of a common reaction that you might get from the Protestant side when anything virgin is discussed. You know, one possible reaction is more kind of the visceral, kind of knee-jerk Protestant reaction against anything that's most Roman Catholic, you know, or anything that might bring forth the image of the Virgin. I was not raised in the church in Panama, but I was familiar with Roman Catholicism, at least as part of the culture. So looking at an image of a Virgin wasn't particularly offensive to me, at least culturally speaking, you see. So, I mean, that's part of a reaction, you know, and maybe it's simply good to recognize that at times we might perhaps even be sort of Karlstadt-like when it comes to images. You know, we go into the church, we want to throw away all the images, including the images of the Virgin and all of that stuff, you know. Now, that is not to say that one is not cognizant of times when the image could perhaps take over the centrality of Christ and so on. But at least I'm throwing that out there as a kind of a knee-jerk reaction to Guadalupe. Another possible reaction is to sort of see Guadalupe as a kind of unenlightened faith. You know, that's often sort of your more scholarly take on Guadalupe, you know. It's sort of part of the faith of these people who don't really know any better. Their faith has not reached some kind of maturity, and so they hold on to these images. But in reality, it's just kind of a popular appropriation of the Christian life in some way, and so we can sort of deal with that. And maybe it doesn't take very seriously the meaning of the symbol or of the image for the people. So those are some reactions. Then you have reactions of sort of tolerance. You know, we can sort of let them deal with the image as long as at some point we move them beyond that. So in order to become a Christian, you have to leave behind Guadalupe and all the possible functions of that image. Okay? So you see any number of reactions. Then you have sort of the deceptive use of the image. And this has happened in some Lutheran congregations. I'm not sure how many of them LCMS. But they will put an image of Guadalupe out in front of the church to sort of, as kind of bait, you know, for people to come in. And then they don't really deal with the image. So not the best pastoral way of dealing with things either, you know. So now we're going to deceive you into believing that we take seriously Guadalupe. And then once you come in, that is not the case. These are some of the Protestant reactions. Now, Lutherans, where do Lutherans sort of fit into this thing? I mean, on the one hand, we don't think of ourselves necessarily as Protestant, you know, where we have no use for images, where there is no place for the Virgin in some way. After all, for example, the Magnificat is part of our own liturgy. We don't use it that often, you know. On the other hand, we don't want to appear that we're Roman Catholic and that we hold to things like the Immaculate Conception or the Assumption of Mary or Mary as intercessor and things like that, you know. So you're kind of caught in the middle, you know. Now, in some sectors of Lutheranism, they like to speak of Lutherans as neither Protestants nor Roman Catholics, but as Evangelical Catholics. And this is where someone like Maxwell Johnson would sort of place himself when he looks at Guadalupe. And he says, well, you know, we don't have this kind of reaction against all things Virgin. But on the other hand, we don't want that to take the place of justification by grace through faith in Christ. You know, so he likes to speak of the Virgin as sort of a cultural incarnation of the gospel. And I'll have to get into that in just a little bit. But these are at least some of the Protestant sort of reactions against the Virgin. Now, let me move a little bit into Virgilio Elizondo, who is this Roman Catholic theologian, a Mexican-American too, by the way, and see how he sort of portrays Guadalupe. He portrays Guadalupe in three ways. He sees that the Virgin Guadalupe could be portrayed as a sort of an evangelist, also a liberator type of figure, and finally as what he calls Mother of the New Creation. So now let me just say a little bit about these three things. First, you have to understand the background, the historical background in which this apparition of Guadalupe supposedly took place. The historical background is the violent clash between Spanish conquistadors and indigenous peoples. Okay. And this creates mestizaje, you know, the coming together of the Spaniard and the Indian, and often not by peaceful means. Okay. So is this event a cause for shame? Are we to look down now on the mestizo, on the product of this sinful, in a sense, relationships and this tragic clash of civilizations? Or can mestizos be accepted in God's eyes? See. So through Guadalupe, because she's a morenita, right? She's a little brown virgin that has now some significance. Okay, through Guadalupe, one can perceive that the gospel is not something only for the Spaniards. But now La Morenita, by symbolically using Juan Diego as a messenger, has basically said to these oppressed peoples that it is okay to be a mestizo Mexican, that the gospel is for you too. There are some people who would argue that, good or bad, but the argument is made often that without La Virgen, Mexico would not have received Christianity or Christ. So in other words, whether the apparition took place or not, see, is the power of the symbol, you see, that the Virgin now basically says, by being a mestizo virgin, that, you know, God also looks favorably to you mestizos, okay? So here, Elizondo reflects on that powerful image of Guadalupe and says, here Guadalupe appears as a kind of bearer of good news. Maxwell Johnson speaks of this kind of significance of the symbol as gospel-like. He's not willing to say that it's the gospel per se, although at times he moves that way and says this is kind of a cultural embodiment of the gospel. But at least sort of gospel-like, in that there is some kind of acceptance of the mestizo by a merciful God. So that's Mary, the Guadalupan Mary as an evangelist. Then you have also the background, and it's basically kind of along the same lines. You have a once proud indigenous civilization now being totally decimated by the Spanish crown. So Indians who were once warriors and providers became the slaves and the peons, the lower classes of the New Mexico. So is this a cause for resignation or hope? So in the midst of this historical background, you have a virgin, a morenita, who approaches this lowly peasant, see, the poorest among the poor, and empowers him to be a spokesman before the bishop, who represents sort of the center of power. And so here, Elizondo reads the significance of Guadalupe as one who identifies with the poor, one who is in solidarity with the oppressed, okay? A sign of her liberating power, this kind of thing. So the function of the symbol here is Guadalupe, not so much as bearer of good news, but now as one who is in solidarity with the poor. Therefore, Guadalupe the Liberator. And finally, Elizondo goes into this image of the mother of the new creation. Okay, and I think that might be sort of the title of that book, Guadalupe, Mother of the New Creation. We go back to that violent clash between the Spaniards and the Indians. Is this a cause for shame, or is this the sign of something new? Can God bring something good out of this violent encounter? Okay. And so, because La Virgen embodies in her skin tone the mestizaje of the New Americas, in a sense, Elizondo reads that as the Virgin sort of blessing and empowering the radical composition of the cultures in the Americas. So what does that mean? That means that Guadalupe now becomes sort of a symbol of affirmation of the dignity of all humans, of color peoples, of the mestizo, of people of other tongues and tribes and status. And sometimes that is portrayed as sort of a symbol of the Catholicity of the church, you see. So this is Elizondo on Guadalupe. And I think what Elizondo is kind of reacting against is the idea that one necessarily has to see Guadalupe as sort of the incarnation of a pagan god or goddess. So is this the only way to look at Guadalupe, or is there another significance to the symbol? Okay. And so he offers Guadalupe as evangelist, liberator, mother of the new creation. Okay. Now, before I go into maybe some ways in which, as Lutherans, we can appropriate the Guadalupan symbol or critique it, I want to maybe open it up for some questions or comments or reactions to what you have heard so far.
One of the things I found unusual when you were giving the background of the history was that it he spotted her in the same place that you said an Aztec god had had. Was that a similar god to maybe the way the Virgin manifested herself?
Yeah. So in other words, because the apparition took place where formerly a goddess was worshipped, you know, does one interpret the Virgin of Guadalupe as sort of kind of a pagan guy with a virgin mask on, kind of stuff, you know? And that's, I mean, that is a possible reading of Guadalupe. Then I think you have to get at sort of some of the implications if one were to go that way. You know, one would probably have to say that the Virgin of Guadalupe is basically sort of a demonic plot, you know, to sort of take people away from Christ, you know. Or you could sort of go the liberationist route, which says, Guadalupe is a way in which the natives become subversive over against the powerful. And the way they do it is by worshiping the same goddess, but under the guise of Guadalupe, you know. So you can go one of two ways, you know. You do have, you have sort of a classical Protestant reading would be, for example, that this might be all demonic, you see. And then on the other hand, you have more contemporary Roman Catholic, actually, liberationist readings, we would say, well, the real significance of this is that here we have a kind of a symbol of resistance. I think maybe the Protestant reading where everything is demonic, what might get lost is that the symbol could function in other ways that might be theologically significant, and we might miss on that. The problem with the liberationist reading could be that everything is only interpreted in terms, the interpretation of Guadalupe is only seen in terms of kind of power, but there is no further meaning behind it, you know. So I think Elizondo is trying to say, create space for saying that, you know, there might be something here more significant about Guadalupe, you know. Now, the question that it raises for me is whether, you know, how helpful is Guadalupe to actually present the gospel to someone, or present Christ to someone, or how helpful could she be as a bridge to bringing others to Christ? When does Guadalupe become an obstacle, rather than a bridge? But yeah, there are interpretations I would see veneration of Guadalupe as basically pagan worship, you know, and I don't think that we can rule that out completely, but is that the whole picture? Yeah.
Well, in that sense, then, is she just like another one of the saints or another one of the Marys, or is there, maybe you're going to touch on this later, but are there specific rites or things that people do that are a little bit different than the mainstream Catholicism, or that go beyond mainstream Catholicism?
On Virgin of Guadalupe, I suppose there are probably different kinds of expressions of Guadalupan piety, but I think it depends in many ways on what the significance of the symbol is for the person. What I mean by that is, under the banner of Guadalupe, and Professor Kempf already showed you what that sort of looks like, but under the banner of Guadalupe, you have wars of independence being fought in Mexico. You know, Miguel Hidalgo, for example. You also have the Virgin of Guadalupe prominently displayed in Cesar Chavez's struggle for, you know, the rights of farm workers. Even Subcomandante Cero over in Chiapas, you know, he's kind of revolution, you know, it's under the Virgin of Guadalupe. So obviously for them, the way the symbol functions more political, right? So it's one who is kind of on the side of the oppressed, and, you know, there is kind of the liberating power of Guadalupe. So for them, it functions in that way. Now, for other people, there might be people who never actually go to church or go to church once in a while, but they might be wearing a Guadalupe tattoo, right? So what does that say? Well, for them, the symbol functions more as sort of affirmation of the dignity of the Mexican. You know, it affirms my identity because it's a mestizo woman, and so, you know, and so it's more about sort of ethnic, you might say, pride. Now, that could be interpreted in a bad way or in a good way, you see. But in a place where I am put down because of my skin tone or because I don't speak good English kind of stuff, here we have someone who can affirm my mestizaje, you know. So then it functions in that way, you know. Then there are other people who approach Guadalupe in ways that any devout Roman Catholic might approach the Virgin, you know, where she serves as an intercessor, you know, where I might come to church and bring candles and put a candle there in front of the image and then pray for her to intercede before me for my family or for a good job or this or that, you know. So there are some practices, as you can see, that might be in continuity with traditional Roman Catholic theology and other practices that might not necessarily connect with Catholic understanding of how marriage should function, you know. So then it's become more solidarity with the oppressed and or affirmation of identity, you know. So I guess as a pastoral kind of approach, when you meet someone for whom Guadalupe is important, you have to kind of understand what is the meaning producing dimension of the symbol that they're holding on to, you see. And then the next question is, well, is that helpful or not? You know, yeah.
I think one of the symbols also, along with the nationality, is that she is the protectorate of the country and of its people. Mm-hmm. In other words, you can take refuge under her, with her, and so the symbol, you wear it, you put it on your automobile, you hang it in your house, and it also, alongside with the whole nationality, it's also a protectorate. In other words,
yeah,
if I have it, she will protect me. So maybe that has that mixture there, again,
right,
with Catholicism and the symbol of its nationality.
Yeah, and I think this idea of the image of the Virgin as protecting the household or the family or the nation, that could be seen as kind of an impersonal reality where it's almost like an amulet. You know, if I carry my Virgin image, then everything will be okay. But it could be understood more personally, you know, that here I do have an intercessor who goes before God or before her son on my behalf. Then you're dealing with Roman Catholic theology, you know. I think a Roman Catholic theologian, when he sees the Virgin image being used as an amulet, I think that they would typically just sort of react against that, you know. But it's no different in some ways than going to a home where a Bible is open in Psalm 23. You know, and so that's going to protect my home and my family and nation, you know. So sometimes you have similar practices in Protestant homes. you know, where you have the image of the Bible being used, but not necessarily that the Bible will lead anyone to Christ, you know. So the question, what is scripture for, comes up, you know. Well, the same question we could ask of Guadalupe, what is the image for? What function does it serve, and is that helpful or not?
I remember in Mexico City, I got in a cab, and the cab driver, hanging on the rearview mirror, had a symbol of Guadalupe in it. It even had like gold around it and so forth. And before we started, he grabbed the image, gave it a kiss, and then hung it again. And I asked him why he did that, and he says, well, when you drive in Mexico City, you need all the protection you can get. So for him, it was very much that kind of a...
Huh. Yeah. Well, you think also of something like the crucifix. You know, some people wear the crucifix as an amulet. You know, if I have the crucifix, you know, then I will be protected, everything will be okay. But in what sense does the crucifix lead someone to Christ? You know, in and of itself, it doesn't necessarily have to. You know, it might be a powerful image. It might evoke images of solidarity with the poor. You know, it might evoke images of one, I suppose, who gives his life for us. Although I'm not sure that that was a predominant image I got out of the crucifix before coming into the church. To me, it was more sort of a God who was unjust, you know, letting an innocent man die kind of thing, you know. How is this going to save anybody kind of stuff, you know. So, what are the meaning-producing dimensions of a symbol? You know, and you'll have to see where people are coming from there. Now, let me share a couple of things on resources from the Lutheran tradition. There might be many, okay, but these are just some things to think about and see how that, you know, these suggestions resonate with you. But one of the places that I went to was Luther's commentary on the Magnificat, and see what Luther sort of gathered out of Mary's song and confession. And so let me read a little bit from Luther here in the Magnificat. We come to the word Magnificat, which means to magnify, to exalt, to esteem one highly, as having the power, the knowledge, and the desire to perform many great and good things, such as those that follow in this canticle. Even as a book title indicates what the contents of the book are, so this word Magnificat is used by Mary to indicate what her hymn of praise is to be about, namely, the great works and deeds of God for the strengthening of our faith, for the comforting of all them of low degree, and for the terrifying of all the mighty ones of earth. We are to let the hymn serve this threefold purpose, for she sang it not for herself alone, but for us all, that we should sing it after her. So, three things that come out of it as I read this. What is the purpose of the hymn of praise? What is it about? What is the praise to be about? First, the great works and deeds of God. Second, for the strengthening of our faith. Third, for the comforting of all them of low degree, and for the terrifying of all the mighty ones of earth. So as I was looking through that description of what we should gather out of the Magnificat, which here Luther says is not only Mary's song, but the church's song, in a sense, Mary is kind of a type of the church, in a sense, you know. The first thing that we gather here is that, you know, perhaps the Magnificat does allow us to appropriate to some extent Mary Christologically. So in the first place, could we say, for example, that Mary here is the evangelist who points to God's deeds in Christ, and through such good news of gospel, comforts and strengthens our faith? You know, if we could see Mary in light of the Magnificat this way, maybe there is a point to thinking of Mary as an evangelist. And perhaps of the Mexican embodiment of Mary as Guadalupe, as one who could perhaps point to Mary as bearer of good news. So that's one possibility. Now, second, Mary is also this lowly virgin who comes from Galilee, marginal Galilee. She comes from among the poor and the oppressed, and therefore is in solidarity with the needy. So through her song, she announces that God hears the cries of the poor and humbles the powerful. Okay, so there you have kind of another picture. Could we say that here Mary is kind of a sign of hope for those of lowly degree, that God's mercy comes to us from even the most unlikely of places, and that God can use even the most unlikely people of low degree to serve as communicators, people like Mary or Juan Diego, as communicators of his good news. So maybe there is a sense in which Mary is not only the evangelist, but in a sense one who is in solidarity with the lowly. Is this like Virgilio Elizondo's Mary the Liberator? Okay. And then, and you know, Luther doesn't get into this in the Magnificat, but then I was thinking of Elizondo's new creation image for the Virgin of Guadalupe. Could we see Mary as the mother of the new creation in the Christ, in a Christological way? And what I mean by that is Mary conceives in her womb the Christ child, the new Adam, the firstborn among many brethren, so that through him we might become a new creation that is composed of believers from many tribes, languages, see, that includes, in other words, kind of a mestizaje. So, you know, these are some thoughts. Can Mary be appropriated Christologically, and is Luther's Magnificat one way in which that could be done? So, you know, that's one Lutheran resource that I kind of went to right away. And then I see that there are some possibilities to connect this with the Apology 21 on the veneration of the saints, for example. So when the Apology talks about the threefold honor or veneration that we should give to the saints, first it talks about thanksgiving to God for saints who have used his gifts faithfully to show God's mercy and desire to save humankind. So can we give thanks to God for Mary, see, and her role as evangelist, as bearer of good news, as one who sings about the great works and deeds of God in Christ. Then he says also in Apology 21 that the life of the saints strengthens our faith in a merciful God, reminds us of the superabundance of his love. So here we have God who chooses a lowly virgin from marginal Galilee, and through her service is able to bring forth the Son of God, you know, and show his mercy to humanity in this way. Her song about God's works and deeds in Christ is one that strengthens our faith in a merciful God. And then there is the third point about the threefold veneration of saints, that we imitate their faith and various virtues according to our callings and vocations. So here you have, in the case of Mary, one whose faith we are actually called to imitate, for example, by Luther in the Magnificat. She sang it, that is the Magnificat, not for herself alone, but for us all, that we should sing it after her. See. So, whether you're talking about Apology 21 on the threefold honor or veneration that saints are due, or whether you're talking about Luther's Magnificat and his presentation of Mary, can we use the image of Mary and appropriate it Christologically some way to lead people to Christ, you know? Now, as I say all this, I am not naive, I suppose, to recognize that sometimes threefold honor or veneration could turn into outright worship, which takes the place of Christ, okay, and becomes precisely paganism and idolatry. I mean, so I'm open, obviously, to that very real possibility and reality. And at the same time, when I bring forth Luther on the Magnificat, certainly the whole purpose here is to orient the church towards the works of God in Christ, and not to Mary, you know. So Mary here is a servant to the gospel and to Christ. And so that's what one has to figure out when one deals with someone who, or for whom Guadalupe is an influential symbol. Let me share one more thing, and then I'll open it up for some more discussion here. I'm always struck by Apology 13, where a distinction is made between signs not instituted by God and then signs instituted by God which offer grace. The distinction here is made between, say, something like a crucifix, which is a sign not commanded by God and does not offer grace, and then the sacraments, you know, where you have God's sure promise of forgiveness, and therefore you can be certain that God is there with his grace. But I'm always struck by this distinction. And here's what it says about signs that are not instituted by the command of God. Apology 13. Signs instituted without the command of God are not sure signs of grace, even though they perhaps serve to teach or admonish the common folk. So the crucifix would be an example of this. Nowhere in the scriptures do we have a divine command that there should be crucifixes in the church, or that Christians should be wearing them, or that this in and of itself will offer the forgiveness of sins, you see. Now, can the image of the Virgin of Guadalupe be considered one of those kind of signs? They do not have God's command. They do not make one certain of grace, is not a sure sign of grace, but perhaps they could serve to teach or admonish the common folk. See? So could a symbol like the Virgin of Guadalupe be considered one of these, not sacraments, but signs? Not instituted by God. Maxwell Johnson at Notre Dame sometimes is hesitant to speak of Mary or the Virgin Guadalupe as an embodiment of a sure embodiment of God's grace. It's not exactly the same as the gospel. It might be gospel-like, but not necessarily. And if the symbol is to be used to teach or admonish the common folk, you know, then what does that look like? Is that sort of law and gospel kind of stuff? So there might be ways in which the sign could actually be, well, you know, don't do this anymore because this is not leading to Christ and his gospel. Or, well, let me hear about the significance of the symbol for you. Okay? Why is the symbol important? And let's talk about that and see if a bridge is built to Christ somehow. Is the symbol of Guadalupe, could it function as a sort of preparation for the gospel? Did it function that way back in the times of Juan Diego? When does the symbol no longer serve as a bridge to to Christ, or as an embodiment of the gospel that points to Christ. So, I mean, these are some of the questions I bring up. I'm raising the issue because, as I was saying before, when I was raised in a Roman Catholic culture, I wasn't put off by the Virgin images. I'm still not put off by Virgin images, you know. At the same time, what is the use of the image? What is the function? When does it bring or potentially bring someone to Christ, and when does it become an obstacle? So I'm going to leave some of this open here for you for discussion. I think it's important also to recognize that Mexicans are not concerned about the historicity of the events, right? It's the idea of the symbol and the meaning of the symbol and the meaning-producing dimensions of the sign. Okay. So I'll leave it up for some comments. I don't have definitive answers for you. I'm basically raising an issue. It's a dominant symbol in Mexican-American culture. 65% of Latinos in the U.S. come from Mexican background. Many of them will find the Virgin of Guadalupe significant in some way, unless you're talking about you know, some Protestants, or perhaps even a majority of Protestants from Mexico, who, especially if they come from the Pentecostal background, who will be very strongly against anything that looks or smells Roman Catholic. In the Hispanic Lutheran Church, we tend to get students from both sides. So we might get students who were formerly Roman Catholic, and then we might get students who were formerly Pentecostal, and now they've become Lutherans. So if you had them debate the merits of the use of the image of Guadalupe in the same room, I think they're going to come with two vast different answers to this. You know, it could be that by using it in a parish where you have people coming from a Roman Catholic background to a Lutheran one, that there might still be some use for it. But then you perhaps lose an opportunity to bring in other people who might be from a Pentecostal background and are interested in the Lutheran tradition. Well, you cut your chances there, you know. So it's a difficult question. But, you know, those are some of my thoughts on it, and I invite any reflections or potential pitfalls or...
Well, one of the things you have to take into consideration is the kind of society or culture or worldview that you're dealing with. Traditional societies, when you're talking about the Virgin of Guadalupe as a symbol or as a form and how it functions, in traditional societies, it is very difficult for the people who compose those societies to make a separation between form and function. I mean, form and function go together like body and soul. You can't separate them. Whereas in individualistic societies, or let's say non-traditional societies, there's a very clear distinction between form and function. So when you're talking about using the Virgin of Guadalupe as a symbol or as a form, and distinguishing that from its function, you have to be very careful about what is the cosmovision or the worldview of the people with which you're dealing. If you're working in a very traditional part of rural Mexico, having a traditional society, people are not going to think of, well, this is the form and this is the function, and the form and the function are different. They just don't think that way. Whereas maybe in the United States, when you get into a more individualistic society, that difference between form and function is a lot clearer, and you might be able to use the the Virgin of Guadalupe might be able to serve a useful function, which is separated from its form.
Yeah. Well, and another assumption too that is easy to make is that the use of the symbol has anything to do with the church. So in other words, it could simply be sort of a cultural, you know, a cultural kind of symbol. So it doesn't have to be necessarily tied to the church. I mean, you might have, as I mentioned before, someone wearing a Guadalupe tattoo. In his own worldview, that might mean something, but it might not be necessarily tied to church, per se. Yeah, even in terms of the Mexican worldview, you know, what might be some elements of that worldview, and can those be applied to all Mexicans? I'm not so sure, you know. Some people, when they look at Mexico, they also see a rise in sort of secularism. And I don't know how much to read from that. But it would certainly explain, at least among some maybe elite members of society, why they could see Guadalupe as primarily a political symbol, for example. That again might have nothing to do with the church. You know.
Before the advent of liberation theology, the people that liberation theologians called the dominant elites would use symbols like that of the Virgin of Guadalupe, not as a symbol of liberation or of seeking freedom, but of conformity. The saints functioned as upholders of the society. That although you are poor and marginalized and suffering, the Virgin is with you in your sufferings to be able give you strength to endure those sufferings, but without rebelling against the system, but to accept the system in humility. I mean, at the beginning of the liberation theology movement in the late 60s, the early 70s, there was a conscious effort on the part of liberation theologians to change the function of symbols like the Virgin of Guadalupe and other saints and turn them into symbols of rebellion and liberation and not as symbols of a conformity to the system. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, symbols are multivalent or multivocal. Mm-hmm. They can mean any number of things, and maybe it's the theologians or the politicians that can manipulate the symbol to make it function in the way they want to. So, I mean, those symbols can function even as symbols of oppression or symbols of subjection.
Hmm. So Virgilio Elizondo might be giving us a more contemporary reading on that count of Mary the Liberator. Yeah, that's a good point. So what are you going to do when someone comes to your Lutheran church or the mission field where you're in with an image of Guadalupe?
Definitely dialogue. When I was working before coming to the seminary, I ran across a gentleman who was wearing a cross, just a cross, not necessarily a crucifix. And I liked to strike up conversation, said, I like your cross. I asked him if he knew what it meant. He didn't know what it meant. He said, yeah, maybe, but I got it because it was cool looking. So we had a chance to talk. Hopefully next time he looks at his cross, he's going to realize there's more to it than just a cool symbol. So if somebody came and wanted to talk and I noticed their Virgin of Guadalupe, after this informative session, I would be better equipped to have some dialogue and talk about, like you said, what their view, what viewpoint they're coming from, and then bridge that by adding new significance to the symbol. Next time they see the symbol, maybe they'll think about our conversation.
Yeah, and I mean, in a sense, one of the things that, I mean, that maybe I'm trying to do here, is there a way to, I think there is something to the handling of symbols, like Professor Blank was talking about here, you know, that is there a way in which we could take a symbol and what it means seriously enough, but actually interpret or find its fulfillment or reinterpret it or whatever language you want to use along biblical Christ-centered lines.
I think there are plenty of examples in church history where that's done.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them have been popping into my head while I've been listening.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
For example, I came into Lutheranism from an Eastern Orthodox background. Mary certainly is prominent in Eastern Orthodox piety, although the understanding of her is different than it is in Roman Catholicism. But another saint who is nearly as prominent is Saint Nicholas in the Orthodox Church. But try to connect Nicholas, Bishop of Lyra, with Saint Nick, Santa Claus. They're miles apart. He is a symbol as a saint who's been appropriated by the secular world and many times has no connection to the Christian meaning of the holiday that he's associated with. As Lutherans, we, I think, all know the Christmas tree has pagan origins, and yet it's been appropriated into a Christian meaning. And yet, as signs,
mm-hmm.
we don't always have the ability to control what they mean to the culture.
Mm.
And so we're very comfortable with them. The culture is very comfortable with them. And yet there are very different things going on. That's what you're describing with the Virgin of Guadalupe as well. Is there a Christian significance to these different things? Of course. But the church has to be the one to articulate those things. And where a sign becomes culturally predominant without those attachments to its gospel significance, I suspect it's a symptom of the church having failed in doing its job. I'm uncomfortable with the language of talking about how can we use this sign. It sounds awfully manipulative to me. I'm much more comfortable talking about what is the meaning of this sign, and what I'm saying here fits with the Virgin of Guadalupe. What is the meaning and significance of this sign? How can we take that? We can't change it. That would never work. You can't just detach it from its associations to the people. But to say, how can we extend that back to the gospel? And I would argue in most cases, reestablish those connections that ought to be there and that aren't.
Yeah.
That becomes a point of contact and a point of beginning for evangelization to someone who understands this sign in a way different from perhaps what it should be, but can still push. And that gets into some of the things that you were talking about in the second part of your talk. You know, in early I'm rambling here, I realize.
No, this is good.
In early iconography, Mary was always and always had to be depicted as pointing to Christ. In a lot of the icons, you'll see that she actually has one hand gesturing so that the somebody who's paying attention to the image will be drawn to the Christ child that's in her arms. Over time in Western church history, that changes, and pretty soon it becomes just a family portrait where there's mom and there's baby, and then baby kind of disappears. It's really interesting to see how it shifts through history. I don't necessarily have a problem with the idea of the Virgin of Guadalupe, even though its origins may be in doubt, because I know there are symbols that I'm very comfortable with whose pagan origins are not in doubt. I know they're pagan, and yet we use them. The Christmas tree is an example. And I lost my train of thought. But it has to point to Christ. It has to be used as that touch point to move on to what the center of the gospel really is. And it seems to me there are lots of opportunities to do that with this sign.
I really appreciate what you say about sort of taking seriously the significance of the sign, as opposed to sounding manipulative, you know. kind of a utilitarian view of, you know, because it doesn't take seriously enough kind of what Rudy was saying too, you know, that form and function go together. So you really have to see what is the meaning of the sign from within the culture with all the various meanings or associations, see, and then take that seriously too, as opposed to kind of homogenizing the significance to just one thing, you know. And sometimes I think Dallas, I mean, even something like conversation with people, you know, because we might assume that there's a certain meaning that's collective, and then you talk to someone and they say, well, it's just a cool image to wear, you know. Well, okay, tell me more about that. We'll go here and then.
Building on both of those, part of what's helpful is realizing that it's not detrimental to Christianity and to faith in Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, whether you have the opportunity to talk about it to start with, or maybe it's further down the line, or whatever, it's important to talk about, but it's not something that necessarily automatically takes away from the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
In
mm-hmm.
fact, it can actually point toward the gospel. So mm-hmm. I think that's
yeah.
that's helpful. Like you meet somebody that's you know got the
mm-hmm.
tattoo or whatever, and you don't have to feel like you have to do away with this before you can get to Christ.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and a lot of times it's not even as much of the religious; it's more of the cultural thing. And so I think
right.
that it's helpful to
mm-hmm.
realize that anyway.
Right. I mean, on the one hand, you don't want to assume that it's already sort of the gospel, of course, you know.
Well,
just
right.
like we wouldn't assume that with anybody just coming to church, you know, or coming within, you know, within proximity of the church. But at the same time, we don't want to go and exorcise the devil out of the person either, you know. So there might be something there. Travis, yeah.
Well, just one thought, but then I had a question, too. I think it can work in reverse another way too, in that Guadalupe could also critique our own images of even who Jesus is, in the sense that all images are enculturated in some way. So if I imagine Jesus to be somebody with long straight hair and blue eyes, that's an enculturated image that
mm-hmm.
doesn't bear much resemblance historically. But
mm-hmm.
so that there can be a way that the image can come back and critique my own images of what the gospel is, who Jesus is. But in any event, the question kind of bears on what you were just saying, and since I'm late, if you already covered this, maybe you did, but does the symbolism and meaning of Guadalupe cross ethnic lines in the sense of, obviously, it carries tremendous significance for Mexicans, but
mm-hmm.
if I'm in a Puerto Rican context or a Cuban context or a non-Mexican Latino context, does the meaning change? Is it less? How?
Yeah, I don't know what the experience of Mark and Rudy has been in Latin America, but at least in the case of, I think the significance becomes lower as you go down south. Mexico and Central America, you still have some strong connections to Guadalupe. In Panama, you still see quite a bit of that, but it's not as prominent. And most reflections on the significance of Guadalupe, whether that's religious or culturally or historically, have come from Mexico or Mexican Americans. So I don't know that it has sort of the depth of or the breadth of meaning outside of Mexican American culture. So I mean, that's my impression, but I don't know what your experiences have been in Latin America. Well, I mean, the Pope always refers to Guadalupe as kind of the Empress of the Americas.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think the reading is that because she's a mestiza, she embodies sort of the lamentations and the hopes of the new people of the Americas, which come out of this clash between the Spaniards and the...
Mm-hmm.
So she affirms their dignity and their hope and so on. And it becomes sort of, in Catholic theology, you have some theologians using her as a way of kind of critiquing the Catholicity or the lack thereof of a kind of predominantly, you know, Anglo church or a church that's in the center of power. And so sometimes it's kind of used this way. You talk about criticism.
Right.
You know, she embodies a certain Catholicity that is not reaches fulfillment in our own church here in North America or something. And so it has that, you see some of that when Mexican Americans reflect on Guadalupe. I mean, that's my experience. I don't know.
Well, for many people in Latin America, the different virgins sort of constitute different entities. I mean, they're not all thought of as manifestations of the mother of our Lord, but let's say as powers distinct from one another. For example, even in the Mexican Revolution, the Spanish troops carried on their banners the image of the Virgin of La Virgen de los Remedios, the Virgin of Los Remedios, whereas the rebels carried on their banners the Virgin of Guadalupe, like two virgins, two spirits fighting against one another, the one being, let's say, the patron virgin or saint or spirit or power behind the Spaniards, and the others being the Virgin of Guadalupe. You hear people saying in Latin America, well, I used to go to the shrine of this virgin and pray, but then I found out that this other virgin in this other church, she's more powerful, as ella es más milagrosa, she performs more miracles. When my child is sick, if I go to this virgin, oftentimes I don't get an answer, but if I go to another virgin, that other virgin will respond. And I think there was an article in one of the anthropological journals some years ago, I think by David Carrasco from the University of Denver, where he said, when the Virgin of Guadalupe became the patron virgin of Mexico, it was the time of an outbreak of the plague in Mexico City. And thousands of people died, and the priests and the lay brothers and sisters and the devout went from shrine to shrine in Mexico City, and there's hundreds and maybe even thousands of them, and they would pray for 3 or 4 days before the shrine of Saint Francis and ask for the plague to abate, and nothing happened. So then the group moved to the shrine of Saint Thomas and prayed there, and then they went to the shrine of another virgin, Virgen del Carmen, and prayed. And it wasn't until they came to the shrine of the Basilica of the Virgin of Guadalupe and prayed that really the plague stopped, or I mean, didn't stop overnight, but it showed signs of abating. And I mean, then it was recognized that the Virgin of Guadalupe had special powers in Mexico, and it was at that time that she was named as the patron, the patrona of Mexico.
Right, right.
But an interesting thing that Victor Turner pointed out on the apparitions of the different virgins, like for example in Venezuela, the big virgin is the Virgen de Coromoto. In the state of Portuguesa. But in practically all of the apparitions of the Virgin to people, they practically all have taken place outside of the centers of authority and power, where the bishop or the viceroy or the Spanish government had its power. All of the apparitions of the Virgin were on the periphery, in the territory of the outcast, the Indian, the Negro, the mestizo. And so when there is a pilgrimage, the people have to leave the centers of power or the territory of the dominant elites and all don the same kind of penitential garb, where there's no distinction between the rich and the poor, the powerful and the unpowerful, the black and the white, and they have to move out of the territory of the powerful, of the elites, and move into the space of the outcast or the marginalized, the Indian, the mestizo, the black, and have their encounter with God there, or like Gustavo Gutierrez, mm-hmm. The patron saint of liberation theology, would have to say, the poor are the sacrament where one finds God. You cannot find mm-hmm. God in the centers of power where the dominant elites suck the blood out of God's people. But the powerful elites have to, the rich Wall Street bankers have to go to Harlem to find God if they're going to find him at all.
Well, and wouldn't that be uniquely American, though, too? Because in the old world, it would be the opposite. Pilgrimages go to the centers of, you know, the Hajj, mm-hmm. you go to Mecca, mm-hmm. or, you know, mm-hmm. you go to the cathedral, or wherever the pilgrim.
One of the four basilicas in
Jerusalem.
Rome.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
One of the four basilicas in Rome,
mm-hmm.
kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But even the
yeah.
Virgin of Fatima, I mean, it's purest of peasant children that are on the margins.
Mm-hmm.
True.
Well, this reminds me also of the Black Christ of Portobello.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the people who go on pilgrimage, they represent all different.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was, that's one of the things that Virgilio Elizondo brings up, you know, this image of Mary as one who comes from the lowly classes, who identifies with the oppressed mestizos, and who at the same time embodies the Catholicity of the Church, so that in a sense, even the dominant masses are but one dimension or one aspect of that greater, richer Catholicity. You know, so I mean, symbols function as critiques of the powerful too, and Guadalupe is one of them. But again, you know, it's helpful to have this conversation with people, what they gather from Guadalupe, and then go from there, you know.
Even going back historically, and like Leo mentioned, Mexican people today don't know about history or haven't investigated
yeah.
that. But even Tonantzin, who was the goddess on whose holy hill the Virgin supposedly appeared to Juan Diego.
Mm-hmm.
Tonantzin was originally not an Aztec goddess. She was a Toltec goddess. And when the Aztecs conquered the Toltecs oh. about 150 years before the Spaniards came, she was the goddess in which the Toltecs looked for refuge and protection from their Aztec conquerors. Who had destroyed
mm-hmm.
their gods, and in a way, the old Toltec goddess who became Tonantzin, she had another name that began with C that I break my tongue in trying
yeah,
to pronounce. She wasn't a very
Islam.
Nice god because she received human sacrifices and loved to, the sacrifices of little babies and children and not the kind of goddess that I would want tattooed on my arm. But anyway, she was a Toltec goddess who was incorporated into the pantheon, the Aztec pantheon,
yeah.
and became an Aztec goddess. But
mm-hmm.
her roots go back much further in the history
yeah.
of religions.
Right. Well, but you know, what's interesting is that at some point, I mean, I think it's a good question. You know, to what extent this kind of historical background for an image drives the show? And to what extent is there a reinterpretation? So you talked about symbols that are pagan,
mm-hmm.
then they're reinterpreted. Well, you could do the same thing with Tonantzin or whatever, you know,
sure.
you know? And then...
we did it with
yeah.
Saturnalia Festival on December
yeah.
20th.
Well,
I still remember...
the feasts of the Old Testament,
yeah.
Passover, Tabernacles,
yeah.
Dedication, Pentecost, were originally pagan festivals that were
mm-hmm.
recycled connected with salvation history and became feasts of the people
mm-hmm.
of God.
Yeah.
Back to your question about Latin America and other experiences, I think what I've noticed that has happened is that there is a sense often of competition.
Mm-hmm.
Because what Dr. Blanc was saying about, you know, who performs the better miracles, or
mm-hmm.
who is more consistent with their people, with her people.
Right.
Therefore, then the Virgin becomes a little more prominent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And maybe that happens through media. I don't know if any of you have watched one of the Spanish channels, Univision, but they have an extremely popular program. It's called the Rose of Guadalupe. And what they're doing is day-to-day kinds of issues are resolved by the Virgin. And so my reading into it is there is an agenda here of trying to promote the Virgin of Guadalupe as a faithful miracle provider for people.
Right.
And so what I heard a lot, especially in Venezuela and in Colombia, is the expression, if God wills it so, and the Virgin. Si Dios quiere y la Virgen. In other words, even the
mm-hmm.
will of God is related to the
mm-hmm.
will of the Virgin. So if the Virgin does perform miracles and does demonstrate her will for us, then she becomes a little more prominent.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other side of it is every country in Latin America has its preference
mm-hmm.
for the Virgins, even mm-hmm. though there may be many.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the Virgin of Guadalupe is gaining a little more territory. I remember
mm-hmm.
one instance in Panama, just watching, they were selling all these images of the Virgin of Guadalupe, and there were some small ones that were about 3 or 4 inches tall, and there were others that were about a foot tall. And the salesperson was trying to sell one of these, and the lady that was buying it says, no, I want the big one, because then I will be guaranteed that there will be greater miracles because it's been proven in other countries. So
mm.
that's why she bought the Virgin of Guadalupe.
Sure.
So maybe that
mm-hmm,
also
mm-hmm.
is happening. So there's a sense of,
right.
even amongst, I think, people looking for miracles and signs,
mm-hmm.
which is not uncommon in humankind, but whoever provides the better results, then that's the one that we go to.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
maybe that is
yeah.
happening too.
You know, I think one of the issues that the you're all raising is whether before one can appropriate Mary Christologically, one first has to appropriate Mary, you know, in some way that is sort of salutary in the first place, before you can even talk about moving on to something else. So anyways, one of those signs not commanded by God, not a sure sign of grace, but could it serve to admonish and teach the common folk? I leave that reflection up to you. But for now, thank you for your comments and for being here with us.